Hey everybody, welcome to Schoolside Podcast. We're excited tonight to be talking about report writing and super another nerdy topic we love. Really excited to be here. My name is Rachel. I'm a school psychologist working in Maryland, and I'm going to pass it over to Rebecca, who's going to tell everybody how to participate tonight. Rebecca?
Hi, everybody. Sorry about that feedback. I think that was me. but yes, we're very excited for this topic. And I'd like to remind those of you who are watching live to please sign into your Google account so that you can comment right alongside this video. I'll be looking out for comments and sharing them with Dr. Carrier. And also, you can comment on Facebook, either on School Psych, Your School Psychologist, or the School Psych Podcast page. You can comment right at the event, under the post for the event, or in messages, and on Twitter using the hashtag PsychedPodcast. If you're watching or listening, not live, but later in the week, we welcome you as well. We're really happy that you are here. And please continue the conversation over time. We're still going to be looking for messages. And if you have questions or comments, we will try to get them to our wonderful guests. And now here is Eric.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eric, and I'm a school psychologist in Connecticut as well. And before I introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Jeannine Carrier, we have a poll that Rebecca set up through Facebook that asks some questions about aspects of legal aspects of evaluations and legally defensible IEPs. And so a couple of questions. The evaluation should be comprehensive. The evaluator should use a variety of assessment tools. Evaluations should be fair. The evaluator should be competent. These were some of the points introducing the poll. And then some of the questions then were, what are things that, what are barriers? And what are things that might interfere with our ability to either do comprehensive assessments or do assessments that we feel are the best of our ability. By far, our highest response was excessive caseloads with 134 responders. Limitations of time with 82 came in next. Lack of understanding and or support among stakeholders about the evaluation process, 37 votes. Collection and discussion of performance data, curriculum-based assessment, symptoms or behaviors linked to the problem, 27 votes. There were a few others that had lower votes, but those were our top four or five that seemed to be impacting responders. So we had a lot of response to the poll. It sounded like a lot of interest in tonight's discussion. So Dr. Jeannine Carrier, PhD, is a licensed psychologist and over 25 years experience working within the public school system. She's the director of the Families and Schools Together FAST program, which is a collaboration between the Center for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Disorders and Chapman University's Atala College of Educational Studies. As part of FAST, Dr. Carrier designs and presents a range of workshops to advance expertise of educators and service providers and community members working and living with children with neurodevelopmental disorders. She also collaborates with medical and clinical providers to conduct multidisciplinary evaluations and consults with local school districts to support comprehensive ASD evaluations. She's an assistant clinical professor for the Chapman University School Psychology Program, teaches graduate classes, supervises school psychology fieldwork students. Her professional interests include effective report writing, comprehensive autism assessment, autism assessment, and making assessment information meaningful to teachers and parents, and support for parents in understanding and involvement in their child's special education program. She's also a co-author with Dr. Michael Haas, the book Useful, Writing Useful, Accessible, and Legally Defensible Psychoeducational Reports. So with that, we are excited to hear you tonight and hear everything that you have to tell us about legally defensible IEPs and comprehensive assessments.
Okay, you guys. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. I love talking about report writing because I really actually enjoy report writing. And it's funny because my husband just walked by and he heard the intro and said, wow, that sounds really impressive. So you can just call me Jeanne-Anne. I'm very comfortable with that. And so the first thing I probably need to say, and I do have a few slides that I'm just going to talk from, is I know you guys titled this, Looking at Legally Defensible Reports. And so I am going to imagine that the vast majority of people tuned in because that is sort of, from all the trainings we do, we find that that draws people in. That's typically like the number one concern of new psychologists, that they're just terrified of somehow going to due process because of their report. And what we find is that when we have people, 100 to 200 people in a room, and we have them raise their hand, very, very few of them have ever been to due process. I think it's a fear that we have that actually doesn't happen very often. I am very comfortable with that fear because I feel like we should enter into every evaluation and write every report like it's going to go to due process. But sometimes it's nice to assure people that I've worked in large school districts in very contentious schools, and in all my years, I've never gone to due process. And that's not because I'm a rock star school psychologist. It's because of a lot of different things, hopefully one of them report writing. So even though we're going to talk about legally defensible reports, what's really important to me is that we talk about reports that are useful and accessible to the reader. And with every ounce of my being, do I believe that if our reports are useful and accessible, they are much more legally defensible. So there's just a little lead in. If you thought you were coming in for legally defensible, you're going to get a little extra.
Awesome. Okay. All right. So I know you have some slides. So I'm going to give me a second. And I'm going to bring that up and we'll go from there. Okay,
okay.
Should be going.
Okay, so I'm also typically doing this in a sort of a back and forth manner so I can get feedback from the audience and I ask a lot of questions. And so I'm gonna ask those same questions and you just get to answer to yourself because I think it's important to get you thinking about it. And so really, number one, why did you tune in tonight? Why was this an interesting topic to you? Why do you write reports the way you write reports? So did you learn it that way in graduate school? Did you learn it that way from a single supervisor? Do you do it the way you do it because your district created a template and so you have to use it? Do you use a electronic system that creates a report for you? And so really thinking about why do you write the way you write and where you learned it? And most people learned report writing in their field work. Very rarely did they actually have a whole class on it. If it was taught in chunks. Like maybe you learned to write up certain sections in a cognitive assessment class, or you learned to write up something in a social emotional class. But very rarely do students get an entire class on how to pull everything in together into a good report. And so you get that when you go into field work. And unfortunately, sometimes that means that you're learning something that takes up a huge part of your day and practice from one or two people. Maybe those one or two people did a great job, maybe they didn't. And then sometimes when we get into a school district, we're given a template or given these guidelines to follow, and we just do it, but we don't really know why. So think about, you know, where are you coming from right now? The talking points for tonight is we're gonna really talk about what are the purposes of psychoeducational reports, what makes one legally defensible, more importantly, what makes it useful and consumer friendly, how can we really reconceptualize report writing so that we meet all those needs, and then what can you change in report writing practices to make your reports more useful, accessible, and I believe because of that, defensible. I know, so I've done a lot of presentations on this, and oftentimes they're entire days. So I'm not going to be able to talk about in depth about every single one of these, but really just want to highlight some points and then address questions. So next slide. So why do we write reports? Well, there's lots of reasons. One is we're truly addressing the concerns and questions of parents and teachers or whoever the referring party was. It is our time to accurately document, integrate, and synthesize data from a comprehensive evaluation. And you guys just talked a little bit about what a comprehensive evaluation is, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. And I really want to highlight the words document, integrate, and synthesize. I read hundreds of reports, and I travel all over the country talking about report writing. And what I have seen is a significant decrease in being a psychologist. I've seen a significant decrease in people really looking at all their evaluation data and integrating it together or synthesizing it into meaningful content for the reader. What I'm seeing a lot more of is people regurgitating raw data or data and then really leaving it up to the reader to figure out what that means. I feel pretty strongly that's not the reader's job. The reader's job is not to figure out what you're trying to say. That's our job. And so that's something I think a lot of us really need to work harder on. Our goal is really to educate team members, but not just the people that are working with the child right now, but people that are going to take that report out of that child's file and read it in the future. It is the foundation, and here's the truly sort of legal part of it. It's the foundation for everything that the IEP team does. That evaluation data is how we decide on eligibility. That evaluation data is how we decide on educational needs. And those needs drive the goals and services and placement. And so when we're really looking at, do we have a legally supported or defensible evaluation and IEP, what we really need to look at and make sure is that we see a very clear line or connection between data in our evaluation, identified needs, goals, services, and placements. Because if you ever do have to go to due process, that is what an administrative law judge looks at. That's how they decide if that's how they decide if the evaluation was done well and whether the IEP reflects that. And then lastly, your report provides evidence of compliance with ethical and legal mandates. And I really want to emphasize that word evidence because we're going to talk about that more later. It doesn't tell people that you did it. It helps demonstrate that you did it. So next slide. So what makes a report legally defensible? And I think we have psychologists tuned in or that'll be watching this from all over the country. And so it's important to look at two different things. So the first thing we look at is ethical guidelines. And I think some people think that's kind of funny. Like, are there even ethical guidelines that have anything to do with report writing? Well, actually they are, and we're going to review them. NASP has some very, very clear guidelines, but your state organization may as well. So in California, we have a few of them, but I recently did a presentation in Ohio where they had a lot of them. So I just think it's interesting. So it's something you should check to look to see, does your state organization address this at all? Then we look at our legal guidelines. And so, of course, we all know that we follow IDEA and the Code of Federal Regulations. And then each one of our states takes those and creates our own. So you have your own state education code and regulations. And those are really the guidelines we look to see what has to be in a report and how are we going to create a report that follows those guidelines. Next slide. And so what I think is super interesting, and my colleague Michael Haas and I, who wrote our book with me, found this out really early in our sort of research and sort of diving into how we write, what we write, what we put in our reports, is there is a very clear difference between what has to be included in your report and what has to be true about your assessment. And so sometimes people confuse that. Now, this is the part where I say, it is almost impossible to talk about report writing without talking about assessment. You can't. And so I'll address that in a second. And so what must be included in the report? So a lot of people find it very interesting that IDEA has no opinion what goes in your report. There's absolutely nothing in IDEA about report writing except that you have to write one. So whoever does an evaluation has to write a report. That's it. It's a report for parents. Your state code or your state guidelines probably absolutely has some criteria that have to be in your report. But I think what would stun people is that it's very few. So for example, in the state of California, whoever's doing the evaluation, school psychologist, speech language therapist, by our code, we have to say whether we believe the child meets criteria for special education, under what eligibility, and what they might need. We have to do that. That has to be in our report. There's other states where that doesn't have to be. But again, I want to emphasize it's very few, and I highly recommend you look. Because what ends up happening is that people are either told or just take it for granted that things that their administration or others put in their report has to be there because the guidelines say they do when actually they don't. So that's where we differentiate what has to be true about your evaluation, but it doesn't have to be directly written into your report. And so that's when we go back to IDEA, because IDEA says a lot about evaluation procedures. And as you mentioned when you started with the poll, they're all in section 300.304, evaluation procedures. So you're welcome to look those up, but I'm going to summarize them for you. And basically what they say is that our evaluations have to be comprehensive. They have to use a variety of evaluation tools or approaches that gather functional and relevant data. They have to be fair. They have to use valid and reliable tools and procedures, and they have to be completed by a competent evaluator. Now, we do not have time to go over every single one of those tonight, but I am going to highlight a couple of them because I feel like that's where we're going to get our biggest bang for our buck in our time here. Your evaluation has to be comprehensive. It has to use a variety of evaluation tools or approaches that gather functional and relevant data. What I find is people often don't understand what a variety means, what functional means, and what relevant means. And so our first reframe here is going to be that there are things that have to be included and there's things that have to be true. Report writing is a very integral part of evaluation. And I think what happens is a lot of us think that it's just this perfunctory task that we do at the end. So they'll say, oh, I'm all done with my evaluation. I just have to write the report. Well, I want us to stop saying that and to realize that that report is part of the evaluation. That evaluation is not done until it's written. And that is because I know a lot of us probably have been in the middle of writing a report and realized, oh my God, I'm seeing something for the first time I didn't see here. I should have done this, and really rethinking. So that's one of the first things we want to kind of think about is where is this task in your evaluation? And so what I'm going to do here is just really kind of dive in a little bit to the comprehensive and the variety of evaluation tools a little bit. So if you want, next slide.
Yeah, if I could jump in, I totally know what you're saying as far as I feel like when I'm writing my report, that's when I'm kind of formulating my recommendations and where I'd like to go. I mean, as I'm really like looking at all the data and integrating it and putting it together, I feel like by the time I get to the summary, I'm like, okay, I know what eligibility I'm going to be recommending. I know what this kid kind of. So it does help me to, that report writing really brings it all together.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so when we talked earlier about what has to be included and what has to be true, I need to assure everyone that quoting the law in your report doesn't make it true, nor does it protect you from anything. I feel like people use this as like a little protective talisman. Like, no, I told them that I did it, therefore I did do it. But I'm going to be very honest. In my role right now, I do a lot of independent educational evaluations where I'm going in and doing sort of a neutral evaluation. If a parent isn't, they disagree with the evaluation, something was missing. And this is the first thing I look to see if it's there. Because if this is in your report, it's really easy for me or a lawyer to look at what you did and completely highlight everything you didn't do that you just said you did. And so if there is anything that you take from tonight, I would be so excited if you step back and said, do I cut and paste boilerplate legal language into my report? Why do I do that? Did someone tell me I have to do that? Do I think I have to do that because there's something in the law? I can tell you there's nothing in the law. I have never seen it. It's definitely not an IDEA, and it's definitely not in any state code that I've ever looked at, and I've looked at a lot of them. What the code says is it has to be true. That's it. So instead of us quoting the law, take that out, because that is difficult to read. It is confusing to parents. It's confusing to educators. And let's just go ahead and do it. And in our report, demonstrate that we did it. And so we're going to talk more about that.
That's super interesting. I'm totally guilty. And
I want to say that. Like, there's no, for years, I cut and paste that into a report. And it was often in a different font, a different little box, very random, but it's gone now. So
in the template that I used in the internship, but now where I'm at, I'm pretty sure, and I'll have to look now, but I think that it's in like our report writing program. So I don't even know if that I could take it out without like going to the district and explaining that. So I'm gonna be looking into that.
There you go. And oftentimes that's the case where people are like, it's just, we've always done it, but we don't actually know why we do it. So instead, I challenged people to actually demonstrate how they follow these mandates. And so I've just thrown a couple examples in here. I'm not saying that these are just like the world's greatest examples, but this is an example of how you're like, for this one, I'm demonstrating how I chose a tool and why I chose a tool to evaluate a child, instead of just telling the family that I used an appropriate tool. That was valid and reliable, because in this case, this child had autism and he had been evaluated 3 times by the school district, but appropriate tools weren't actually used. And so this child was perceived to have to be very low functioning and to have very low cognitive ability. When in reality, when he was given a completely nonverbal test, he was in the significantly above average range. And so this was an IEE where, again, it wasn't hard to say that here's a child who has autism. He has very significant receptive and expressive language delays, but tools were chosen to evaluate his cognitive ability that were so verbally loaded, and so they weren't appropriate for him. The tools they use are excellent tools, but so they're valid and they're reliable, but they weren't valid and reliable for this specific case. So instead of just telling the reader that, I'm demonstrating how. The next one is another example of that, and we do, or I do, a lot of second language. We have a lot of second language learners in California, obviously. And so, again, instead of just letting people know that, you know, I did a racially language SES valid evaluation, I'm explaining how and why I decided to do what I did. Now, both these examples at the end have this little thing that says like 8.5 readability, 25% passive sentences. That's going to come in later. But just to let you know, those readability levels are the language level or the years of formal instruction you would need to be able to read and understand that information. Unfortunately, what I don't have up there, but I can let you know, is the quoting the law piece is written. That's at about a 22nd grade level. So you would need advanced literacy skills to understand that. And as I'll say in a few minutes, I don't work with a lot of families where the readers of the reports are going to have advanced literacy skills. And even if they do, lots of research has shown that we comprehend information better if it's at a lower reading level. So we're not having to use every ounce of our cognitive ability to sort of understand what I'm trying to read. So next. Oh.
Do you think that if the law is put into the report writing program or one of those IEP programs, that it would be helpful then if you can't remove it to then reword it in more understandable, more relatable language?
Absolutely. And so oftentimes when that is put in there, it is put in, it's written very legally. To be honest, I don't know if rewriting it to make it more understandable is truly helpful, because it's still the case that if you didn't do what you said you did, it's not legally a defensible report. So it would help the reader understand what our mandates are so that they have more of an ability to figure out if they were followed. But if we don't actually follow them, that's where we have the problem. Does that make sense? And so oftentimes I ask people, I push back and they'll say, well, we have to do it. And I'm like, okay. Sometimes we say we have to do things because we've never done it differently or we don't know how to do it differently. And so I ask them, go talk to your administrators. I work in a very, very litigious area, Southern California, and we absolutely have school districts where they have paid lawyers to create report writing templates for them. I am not a fan of that. In fact, that infuriates me because I don't want a lawyer to tell me how to write reports, but that happens. And in those cases, that's always been in there. They always put that in there. And I feel like it's a hindrance. It's an absolute hindrance to understanding. And in many cases, and in some of the school districts in our area, I feel like it's the way it's written is purposefully difficult to understand.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have the slide? Okay. They can see the slide?
Yes.
Okay. So now I'm looking, what slide are we on? Okay. Can you make the slide bigger so I can see it? Just so I know what I'm talking from?
Do you guys not see it big?
There. I see it big now.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. And so quoting out of the way, quoting doesn't make it true. But the other piece that I really feel that sometimes we're misunderstanding is this idea of comprehensive, variety, functional, and relevant. So IDEA and almost every state guideline very clearly says that we have to do a comprehensive evaluation, we have to use a variety of assessment tools, and we have to gather functional and relevant data. And so briefly, I want to highlight what do those mean? And so comprehensive means two different things in the law. One, it means that we evaluate all areas of suspected disability. I think we know that. And the second is that we evaluate all areas of related need. And so what comprehensive doesn't mean is that we test everything. We don't need to test everything. We only need to test suspected areas of disability and related need. We oftentimes overtest, and when people talk about, like, I'm out of time, it's oftentimes because We overtest children. We don't take the time early on in this process to really figure out what are the suspected areas of disability and possible areas of related need. That truly does need to happen before an assessment plan is even written. That is a process of sitting down with the people who have concerns, the family, the teacher. What are your concerns? What do those look like? Because sometimes families will say something because they've heard it or read it, but I want to verify that's actually what it is. So tell me what that looks like at home. If the parent's saying, I'm really concerned about my child's sensory integration, or I'm really concerned about my child's reading, I will ask them to describe what it looks like and what their concerns are. Because I want to make sure that that's actually what it is. If they're through this conversation and reviewing records beforehand, there is no evidence of a concern, then it's okay to write on the assessment plan that there's no evidence of concern in that area, and then we don't need to evaluate it. I think people are very apprehensive to do this for some reason. And so what I find is oftentimes we evaluate in areas that are so time consuming for us, but I also want people to realize that it's pretty disrespectful of that child and that teacher's time as well. And so I'm a pretty fun person, and so I'm fun to hang out with. It's not super fun to hang out with me and do a Woodcock Johnson. It's not super fun to do any of those things, even though I think it's fun because I like hanging out with children. And so really thinking about every single time I evaluate a child, I am taking them out of their classroom. They are missing instructional minutes. And now it is the responsibility of that teacher to somehow make sure that that child receives everything that they missed. And so we really want to be careful in what we're doing. And so just realizing that comprehensive doesn't mean we test everything in every single area. But we do need to be very careful that we do evaluate in all areas of related need. And so that really does take time. So if I have a parent who comes in and they're worried their child has ASD or autism, that they might, we're going to look at that eligibility. So obviously I'm going to look at things like, or not me, but a team, you know, language, social skills, adaptive behavior, cognitive ability. There's very clear things, but I might not be looking specifically for a reading disability or severe depression, because those aren't always affiliated with the suspected disability. So really the only way to do that and to do it in a time efficient way is to have conversations with those stakeholders beforehand. And so if you are working in a district where you're not part of that process and you are handed a signed assessment plan, then to me, that's where you want to go back and put effort in to making some changes. Because there's nothing worse than you getting a signed assessment plan that says you're going to evaluate in all these areas and you don't clearly know why.
That makes really good sense. I think of a couple of things, the cases I've read or assessments, you know, I've participated on where we come back to the table and perhaps there's preconceived notion that the child should have an IEP and the child clearly doesn't qualify based on the data. And people will say, oh, well, what about ADHD? What about, and you say, well, wait a second, that wasn't part of the original referral. The child didn't demonstrate any, you know, but fishing for a label perhaps, or on the other side of the coin, let me give this teacher and the parents 30 rating scales and, you know, give the kid the full NEPSI and, you know, when we really don't know what we're looking for in those cases.
Right. And so what I try, when I work with my students, I tell them what we don't want to do is what I call it Ouija board assessment, is when we just give a lot of stuff and then we put it on the table and we just move it around till we find something.
Right.
It's not ideal. And I did that for a lot of years. So again, there's no judgment, but this realization that's not time efficient. So when a lot of people me saying you need to do this beforehand, they are like, oh my God, wait, I don't have time. I just told you my concern is time. But in reality, that is time that is absolutely made up later on because you're not over assessing. And we're going to talk more about that. And I know you're just shifting the time you use and making it more meaningful.
That's great.
Okay. And then, so we've got comprehensive and now this whole concept of variety. And so a variety of tools, variety means diversity, not sameness. And so sometimes what I'll see is they'll say, oh, I evaluated their cognitive ability by giving them a Woodcock-Johnson cognitive and a WISC. I'm like, awesome. Okay. That's not a variety of tools. You just did two of the same. Or I will see somebody give something like a comprehensive cognitive assessment, and then they'll use a smaller processing measure that isn't always the greatest tool. And then that's their variety. When in reality, if they're looking at auditory processing, well, that's not a variety either because you just use two standardized assessments. And so a variety means diversity of tools. And so I use something called the Riot. It is a very simplistic concept. I always ask people to raise their hand if they've heard of the Riot because, Brian Leung at LMU in Southern California is the one that came up with it. It is more complex than what I'm going to throw down today, but in general, it's this process of understanding that we review, we interview, we observe, and we test. Every one of those is a powerful tool in and of itself, but they all strengths and weaknesses. But when we put them together and we take convergent data from those pieces, the different weaknesses are taken out by the overall strength. And so when we're really looking at a variety of tools, what we mean is that we've got data from a review of records, interviewing, observing, and testing. And then there's this very simple idea that if you've already got the information you need from reviewing records, interviewing, and observing, do you need to test? And so I don't want to make that too simplistic, but sometimes we actually have all the information we need to say something is present. I would be much more apprehensive to say something's absent if I don't have evidence and review, interview, observe, and not test. So let me give you an example. Most school psychologists like testing. We like testing. That's why we went into this field. It's fun to us. We uncover different things. But we also know that one test score is not a disability or eligibility criteria make. So if you're looking at something like, I'm trying to think of something. I tend to, because of what I do right now, I get very ASD heavy and I don't want to just do that, but I'm going to throw it out because I can think of it quickly. So if we're looking at a child who has social communication problems, we can do a lot of tests to look at that, but we should also have in our review some history that's been an issue in the past through interviewing teachers, parents, maybe the child. We should have evidence that that's also present. And then through observations, we should be seeing that as well. And then we can have test data. We have to have convergent data. The law makes that so clear that we cannot base decisions based on a single test score. But that also means we cannot make decisions based on a single test. And I also see this happen all the time, where we might have solid information from a review, solid information from interviews and observations, but for some reason the test doesn't support that. And then we somehow believe that the other three may not be important, and the test is somehow the most valid piece of information. And that oftentimes is not the case, especially if we're working with kids with ASD. I say to people all the time, when you show up to work every day, are you just, no matter what happened, are you just there to give it your all and give it your best? And it doesn't matter how you slept or what you had for breakfast or who yelled at you before you got to school. It's not true. And so we interpret test data as so powerful when it really can be, but we also have to understand that that may not be the most accurate evaluation data unless we've got convergent data from other sources to support it. And again, that could be a 4-hour talk in and of itself, but just understanding that when we're talking about a variety, we don't just mean more of the same. Okay?
That makes a lot of sense. So question to go with your ASD example. So if you have all those things in your review and your interview and your observations, then you're saying, you don't necessarily need to go and give an ADOS with every single ASD eval just for the sake of giving an ADOS, correct?
Okay. Yeah, kind of. Well, okay, I have to be super careful here because I do a lot of ADOS trainings.
Okay.
And so I love the ADOS, but yes. And so here's what I would say. This is when I'm doing autism assessment talks. The ADOS gives us very powerful information because we are going in and specifically pulling for behaviors. But I would say if I have data from a review, interview, and observations that demonstrate that child has those behaviors and they're present, no, I don't need to do an ADOS. And oftentimes in school districts, we have hours of observational data. Where I think you need to be careful is if you're using interviews and observational data to say behaviors are not present at school at all, then sometimes an ADOS can be very helpful because you're actually pulling for those behaviors. You're putting a child in the situation to do that. Because what happens is oftentimes in classrooms, we scaffold children. They're very supportive environments. And so what we're doing, and this is a great lead in to sort of functional data or functional information, is that we're looking at what children can do in an ideal situation. And kids don't always function in an ideal situation. But yeah, that is the basic premise, is to not, if you've got what you need, but I tend to say if I've got what I need to support, like the presence of something, then you don't need to do more. Autism gets a little tricky because we're not only looking for the presence of atypical behaviors, we're looking for the absence of typical behaviors. And so sometimes those are more difficult to see in super supported settings for kids, like classrooms.
Gotcha. And where do you see rating scales falling as far as, is that considered a test? Or, I mean, that's another...
Yeah, and so that's another great question. Oftentimes, I think people see them as tests because they're standardized. I typically use rating scales as interviews, and then again, people think, oh, my God, how do you have the time to do that? It's because I have sent home so many rating scales and got them back, and I realize, again, it's implied that we do that, that the parent completely understands what we're asking. And so to me, it's just more time efficient for me to go through the rating scale with them. If I can't do that, then I still do an interview of the results because I want to make sure that what that rating scale says, maybe it's a BASC, is consistent with what their thought processes are about their child. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to be shocked. But what I don't want to happen is that I'm in a meeting and I say something like, well, you had clinically significant concerns in the area of anxiety. Like it's a fact. And the parent's like, what? Like, no, I don't. The reality is they absolutely may. But if I would have interviewed them beforehand and we could have talked about that, I could ask again, what does that look like? And explain to them why they popped up higher in that area. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do that a lot also with adaptive behavior rating scales because a lot of parents will be like, oh, yeah, the child, they totally do that. And then I'll go, okay, well, give me an example. And it's like, oh, okay, well, when I start the bath for them and make sure that it's warm or whatever and check to make sure they've washed everything, they do it totally independently and the child's 15. So I always feel like I need to validate whether what they're telling me is true through an interview. So for me, those are kind of combined.
Gotcha.
Okay. And then we have functional and relevant. And I'm looking at time, so I want to get through these a little bit quickly. So functional is exactly what it sounds like. And we don't do a great job of this in schools. And I say we, and I include myself in this. Functional means an application of a learned skill. So what can that kid do in a completely typical environment? So this is beyond what they can do in a testing situation. This is what does it look like in that classroom? And so I can throw out examples, and I know people are going to be going, yeah, that's happened to me. So we tend to use a lot of standardized achievement tests. And if you work in a middle school or high school, I guarantee you it's happened where you give a standardized achievement test and the child comes out within a broad average range, but they have all D's and F's in class. Well, that's because you have not evaluated functional data. So you have evaluated some skills, but what they're doing in those classrooms has very little to do with what's on that achievement test. And so we somehow imply that they're the same things and they're not. So functional would mean you go in and actually look at the curriculum that's being taught and how the kid's responding to that curriculum, especially when we're looking at states, which is almost every one of them, that have Common Core. We have no standardized achievement test yet that reflects Common Core. And so again, it's very common for a child to do really well, maybe not very common, but to do okay on a standardized achievement test, but not to be academically functioning within the classroom. And so that to me, again, is just a perfect example of functional skills. Also, I work with a lot of kids who have can tell you exactly what pragmatic skills they should be using. But then I watch them and they don't use them with anybody else unless they're in their therapeutic setting with their speech and language therapist. And so that's a functional skill. We are mandated by law to collect information on that and to have that be part of our evaluation. And I'm going to be honest, I don't see that very often because functional skills are not often evaluated through tests. Those are really evaluated through interviews and observations. And so important. Relevant is one of my favorites because relevant really means that it's helpful information. So are you collecting information in your evaluation that's gonna help identify an educational need, write a goal, or create an individualized accommodation? Am I collecting information that's gonna assist the people working with the child? So again, really looking at, when I look at my comprehensive evaluation, do I need to be using everything I'm using or do I just use it because I've always used it? And then is it going to provide relevant and useful information for my team? And the reason this one's so important to me is, and this is a story that's in like the first like couple pages of the book, is because when I was dating my now husband, who is a teacher, over the weekend, I was writing reports because that's what I did. And he said to me, I don't understand why you spend so much time on those. Nobody reads them anyway. And I was all up in arms. But the reality is he was right because my reports were not relevant to anyone except to check a box that it was done. And so this has been probably my biggest passion is to make sure the reports I write are relevant to the people reading them. So. And I think that's something we could also do a better job with. Okay. Next. Okay. So we talked a little bit about legally defensible. Now let's talk about useful and accessible. And so research is pretty clear on this. There has not been a ton of research done on this. This is why I did my dissertation on this. This is my, like I joke, this is my repetitive area of interest. Like I do really geek out about report writing. But research says these three things. Has to be understandable by the consumer. That makes sense. They want clearly answered referral questions, and they want clear and feasible individualized recommendations. And so the research has been done, that's been done, has been done on parents, teachers, and administrators. And basically everyone that's done it is finding the same thing, those three things. What is really interesting to me is that if we look at our professional guidelines, they're very reflective of what people want. And so I just put NASPS guidelines up here for people so they can look at them, because a lot of you maybe haven't looked at them since graduate school. But in NASPS guidelines, it clearly says that we have to present findings in language that's clearly understood by the recipients. And so really take a moment to think, am I writing for a parent or am I writing for another psychologist? Who am I writing this for and can they understand it? We're supposed to emphasize interpretation and recommendations. We're supposed to support the recipients in their work interactions. We have to use simple language. We have to use convergent and comprehensive assessment sources. And then my favorite is that reports focused on test scores are rarely useful. I'm seeing more and more of those where there's just pages of tables with test scores, but very little interpretation of what they mean. So not only do we have legal guidelines, our ethical guidelines are really pushing us to emphasize usefulness and accessibility. Mm-hmm. So next slide. And so here's just an example of increasing accessibility. Most reports, and I'm going to talk a little bit about readability levels, but readability level, as I said earlier, is something you can do through your word processing program. You can, when you run your grammar and spelling check, you can click a box and it'll tell you your readability level. I use the Flesch Kincaid readability level, and that is telling me, again, how many years of formal education do you need to be able to read this? I will tell you, research has shown that most reports are written between the 15th and 18th grade level. And so that's pretty high. Though most people will tell me, oh no, I write my reports, you know, 8th, 9th, 10th grade level. It is not easy to write a report at that level. It is something that I have worked out for a long time and oftentimes takes people a long time. Because we are so comfortable with the language we use and how we write that it's difficult to change those things. Did you have a question?
I have a question just about, I read a lot of private evaluations from local clinical psychologists, and I know that they may have, there must be APA guidelines as well on report writing, but what I find happens often is people write, you know, beautiful, they're very comprehensive, probably, I'd say, reports, but then the language is so dense that part of the evaluation process is a face-to-face conversation about the report.
Yes.
Does that make it a little better or not really? Are they not off the hook on trying to make it more accessible?
No, they have the APA guidelines. Their ethical guidelines are almost identical, so they're supposed to be writing reports for us as well, so that we can read them as well. There's clear as day in their guidelines as well. Them sitting down, that's an important part of that, but no, that doesn't get anybody off the hook. Because if you think about it again, we're still going to reference back to that report. And so there's no way even, you know, that a parent's going to completely understand everything. So no, I do think though that the way that clinical reports are written is different than the way that educational reports are written. In clinical reports, they're trained to be in a very like a rule out mode. And so they're written where they're constantly trying to rule things out or talk about the absence of things. So they'll say things like, parent denies drug use. That's not a great way to say that. But that is because it's sort of that training that they have had where as they go through, they're ruling out like, well, it's not drug use, it's not this, it's not that. And so I think that's very reflective in the way they write. I don't like that style. I don't teach students to write that way. And I talk about that in a second. School psychologists are trained. We are so strengths-based. We are trained to be strengths-based. I joke about this when I do trainings on autism assessment, because I can turn anything into a strength. But sometimes that's not reflected in our report writing style if we were trained in more of that clinical style, where we're talking about like the absence of things, like the absence of illness versus the presence of health. So yeah, no, I read those a lot too.
That's helpful. Thank you. I spend a lot of my time explaining the private report or summarizing it in more accessible form. And I'm happy to do it, but it's an extra step.
Yes, exactly. And so I have a little example up there that sort of shows how you go from trying to make language more accessible. And so there it is. And so I actually pulled this quote from a study that was done on report writing. It is my contention that any statement found in psychological reports could be made comprehensible to any literate individual of at least average intelligence. So I think we know what they're trying to say there. But that's at a 17.8 grade level. And honestly, all they're trying to say is I think a psychological report can be written so most people can understand it. I said the exact same thing, but I said it at a ninth grade level. So that is an example of what we should be striving to do in our reports, is take things that we believe are super simplistic and make sense, but it makes sense to us because we've just written it so many times. I mean, I'm sure for a lot of you, you sit down and write a report and it just comes, like, because you have these sort of statements and things that you say often. And so this can be a challenge because you're trying to rethink whether that's appropriate or not. So if you go to the next one, I'm going to just talk a little bit, how do you increase readability? And so really, readability and structure are the two pieces of accessibility that I was going to touch on tonight. Readability is challenging. I know people think, oh, it should be easy. It's not. But basically, we follow George Orwell and then threw a couple in for ourselves, where try not to use a long word when you can use a short word. If you can cut out a word, cut it out. Don't use the passive voice when you can use an active voice. Don't use scientific jargon if you can think of an everyday equivalent. Write in a positive voice. And positive voice doesn't mean like rose-colored glasses. It means writing about the presence of something versus the absence. And then if you have to use a scientific word, explain it. Just give simple language and give examples. And so I have a couple examples that you guys can look at in the next slides of doing just that. Sometimes it's helpful for people to literally just take a paragraph of their report and do this one step at a time. Do I have extra words? Like, I tend to over adjective and adverbs. I like them. And so I've had to learn to cut them out. I used a lot of articles that I didn't need. And I also tend to write in a passive voice. So that was the hardest one for me. So if you go to the next slide, there's just a quick example of, and so I know a lot of us have written something like, John's not experienced any accidents, injuries, or illnesses, you know, or hospitalizations. I must have written that hundreds of times. That is not a great sentence for a lot of reasons. And so it's a 14.2 level. We're going to change it to, John has not experienced any significant changes related to his health and development in recent years. So we basically said the same thing using similar language. Then we go down one more where we take out extra words we didn't need, and we get all to the bottom where now we're going to change it from a negative to a positive, where all we're trying to say is John is healthy. I just lowered it to a 1.3 readability level. And I know some people think, well, she's just joking. I'm not joking. Like that, it's kind of a facetious example, but that is what we're talking about doing, is really looking at the sentences we write and what you're trying to say when you're saying that he's not experienced any of these things is that he has been healthy. So why wouldn't you just say that he's been healthy? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay, and so that is one example. And then the next one just gives an example of a technical term. And I'm not going to read it all because I'm aware of the time. But really, like, I taught kindergarten. And so I use the term phonological awareness. I know exactly what I mean. Families don't. So just because the word is comfortable in my vocabulary, we cannot take it for granted it is in others. So again, in my more clear example, I'm still using that term. I'm explaining what it is. We use terms in our reports all the time that we just take it for granted people understand. And so some of them I really push back, like visual processing, auditory processing. I put people on the spot in trainings and say, you tell me what that is. And they don't want to tell you what it is, especially in front of their peers. Well, that's because we don't have an agreed upon definition of what that is. And so if you're not comfortable explaining exactly what that is, then be very careful about using that term in the report. Okay, next slide. And so the other thing I really wanted to just touch on are report writing structures. And I'm not going to go through all of these. I'm just going to say that the structure we choose is vital to how the person reads it, because that structure guides the reader. Some of us do not have a choice with the structure, especially if we have to use an electronic program or we have to use a template that our district has created for us. But I still think there's things that we can do to make them more understandable. I will tell you that a domain base is usually the most commonly written report style, where domains like cognitive ability, social emotional ability, are different domains and information's organized around them. Unfortunately, oftentimes then they fall back into test-based, where under a certain heading like cognitive ability, we just list off the tests we do. The key problem with both test-based and domain-based reports is that an unbelievable amount of information is tossed out at families, and then it's somehow their responsibility to integrate it all together. So for example, an observation's done, that's its own section. An interview's done, that's its own section. These tests were done, they're their own sections. It should not be the reader's responsibility to take information from that observation, those interviews, and that test data and come up with a conclusion. And oftentimes we leave our reader to do that. Even if we do have a summary at the end, it doesn't always pull all that information together. So if we look at the next slide, I want to highlight just an assessment report model that that I use and that we I train all my students to do this. And the book that we wrote is completely focused on this model. Now, the book was written 4 years ago, and report writing evolves. And so even my report writing is involved in the way I think about report writing has evolved, in that I write something called questions-based reports, and I'm happy to share examples of that with anyone. But we used to push people to change their entire report writing structure, and then we realized that that's really a challenge for people. So instead of doing that, it's really more about incorporating these ideas into whatever structure you have right now. And so this model really incorporates everything that we have talked about in the last slides. And so it really talks about, well, you know what, I'm going to skip this one because it's kind of repeated in the next slide in more of a graphic. And so basically, this model, and it was created by George Batch in 1983. We have just developed it more, grown it more, whatever. It really starts with this looking at the reason for referral. I'm pointing at it like you guys can see me pointing, but in the upper left-hand corner. What are the questions and hypotheses? And we identify these first because it drives everything else. By doing that, you are creating a comprehensive assessment. Then we go into choosing a variety of assessment procedures. Those procedures are directly linked to our questions. I only choose tools I need to answer my questions. Those are designed to collect relevant and functional data. And so again, I'm not just using what I've always used. I'm really taking time after I've clearly identified what those reasons for referral are to choose assessment procedures that are going to collect that data to answer the questions. I conduct my comprehensive evaluation. Then I analyze and synthesize data to answer those specific questions. And so Again, I'm demonstrating a comprehensive assessment, but I'm also demonstrating what research has shown parents want, that I'm clearly answering what their concerns were, and then that drives my meaningful recommendation. So what's important in this model is that it is heavier in the beginning than at the end, because there is this collaborative piece with everybody involved, but that saves so much time because it's so much more efficient. And the way I write my reports is I make sure every one of those pieces is directly reflected in my writing. And so, again, I do that a little bit differently than some people, but I feel like even if you do a domain-based report or you're using a program, these are things you can absolutely incorporate into those. And so if you go to the next slide. And so here's just an example of a very vague reason for referral. I'm not going to read it to you. I'm sure you guys have seen referrals like this all the time. Just basically saying somebody referred him, so we're going to test the kid, and we're done. The next slide has a much more informative reason for referral. And so it gives a little bit of background information. In my report, I'm not writing anything different. I just took information that would have probably been in my background information, and I plunked it into this. And so, again, giving some background information about this child, what are the concerns that we have, what has been done in the past, what the focus of the evaluation is, and then exactly what questions my report is going to answer. Now, I believe that by using questions like this, it is so clear, like someone's going to read this and go, I know exactly what you're doing. I go on and those questions become my report headings, but for other people who can't do that because they have to use a template or they are using a computer program, those questions can still be incorporated. And so what I find them doing is that they'll put that in their referral, they'll put them underneath their domain headings. So for example, it'll say cognitive ability, and then underneath it'll say during this section, we're going to look at his cognitive strengths and weaknesses and how they impact his learning and achievement, and then, you know, then bringing all that information together. So that's just an example. The next is sort of a presentation of assessment procedures. And so, again, your assessment procedures are hand-chosen to answer your referral questions. And so really thinking about what we're doing, I am very specific about what I do, and you can see I organize them around Riot, because right then somebody can look at what tools I chose and say, oh, wow, look, that is a variety of assessment tools. Sometimes I'll see people just put observations or just put interview. I think it's important to say exactly what your observations were, because again, it demonstrates that you have put thought into what you chose to do and why.
We were just having a little sideline discussion and some questions came up. We were commenting how a good pre-referral process is really important so that the referral question makes sense. And one of our viewers mentioned that she's barely involved in the pre-referral process at all. Do you have any advice on how school psychologists can help make sure that the referral pre-referral process and the referral question they receive has been
Sometimes people don't like the advice I give. A lot of states have educational diagnosticians, and I don't know if this person has a state that they have those, where that the educational diagnostician is typically in charge of their part of the SST process. They're there during that, and then they create the assessment plan. That's not great for every reason I said. So my advice is to try to change that. Now, oftentimes people push back and they say, we don't have time. We can't do that. But you actually would have much more time to do that, because you won't be conducting evaluations that aren't appropriate. And so I'm going to throw out something that in the school district I was in, We did a lot of evaluations where a child didn't qualify, like tons. And so when we completely revamped that pre-referral process, we were able to get that down to literally 90%, 80 to 90% of the evaluations we did, a child qualified, which decreased the overall number of evaluations we did and made sure they were appropriate referrals. That is so important to our ability to do what we do. I still get frustrated to do an evaluation where the child doesn't qualify. And I'm not saying that because that child didn't deserve to be evaluated. It's more that if we have a really solid pre-referral process, we should be able to tell if this is the case. And that may be just my different way of thinking, that I don't give as much power to some standardized tests. But I feel like if we really did beef that piece up. And so for people who aren't involved, figure out how to get involved. And maybe that doesn't mean that you get involved the entire process, but that you are involved, even if it's just a phone consultation, to hear about the evaluation, what data has been collected, can I do a quick review of records, do I think this is appropriate, I think is vitally important. Because if not, you're kind of being used as a hoop. And we're not using our skills then.
Right. That's a great point. A couple of other comments and questions I just want to throw in. A viewer asks, does your book include a part about writing summaries and conclusions? Because she's always conducting assessments with other specialists, never herself alone. And then the last one, a comment that she does not write recommendations in her reports because of the software they use, and they have been told by lawyers that those should be.
Yeah. So you were told, and I hear that all the time. So let me go back. Let me address the recommendation one, is that we don't provide recommendations because then we have to do that. Well, I'm going to tell you that if it's a really good recommendation, then you should be doing it. But I will tell you, why did you do the evaluation? That's why I pushed back. So recommendations are the hallmark of usefulness. And so be thoughtful and careful in your recommendations. So an example would be, I would never say, based on this child's phonetic skills, they need Linda Mood Bell. Like, I would never do that, because then we're going to need to provide them Linda Mood Bell, which is incredibly expensive and time consuming. Good program, but instead I'm going to say something like, they are going to need an intensive phonics-based reading program. Recommendations can be written with your team. Recommendations can be the accommodation that you think that child needs in their IEP. I have discussed this with so many lawyers. Writing a recommendation does not mean you have to do it, as long as they're written carefully. What it does mean, though, is you need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So what you shouldn't have is that somebody saying, like, I recommend this child, based on their mental health needs, gets counseling and support at school, and then that's not addressed at all, and they don't get it. That's a problem. So I think people really need to think about what those recommendations are, but the way your district has dealt with that is just to remove them altogether, which really feels like we're not using all those hours of evaluation you did in a useful way. Mm-hmm. And then there was another, I don't remember the question from before that.
Just a question about writing summaries and conclusions with others.
Yeah, and so lots of people do multidisciplinary reports. And so what I talk about with writing summaries is that, so you might have an end of this multidisciplinary report where you pull everything together, but we need to be summarizing information throughout. So, for example, if you are in the cognitive section, there should be a clear summary statement of what you found in that area, so that they don't have to wait till page 40 to figure out what that means. The other thing is that and this again is not, I don't like standalone sections, is that when I, to demonstrate, I used a variety of tools. Remember, I want to use conversion data and my riot. Then when I talk about that child's cognitive ability, if I truly use those tools, I should be pulling information from my interviews, my observations, my reviewing, not just my testing. So oftentimes what I see is a summary statement that's only about maybe the cognitive test they gave, but it doesn't incorporate all that other information. That's how we demonstrate the variety of tools. Because if there is something, like for example, I just did an evaluation for a girl who, it was an 88, they were looking at ADHD and other health impaired. There was so much evidence from report cards, teacher comments, the teacher's scales that they filled out. There was so much evidence that this child had difficulties with attention, but in like one specific testing area, she didn't demonstrate that. So then they decided she didn't need eligibility. And so it was really easy to come back and say, oh my gosh, you guys didn't use a variety of tools. You used one test score. There was all this other evidence. And I was able to basically rewrite their data into my report. Like that's all I had to do. I didn't really have to do anything different. It was just making their information convergent to demonstrate that this child really did have a need. So I understand the difference with multidisciplinary reports. Another thing I see people do is that they just have solid summaries in each one of their sections, and then there's the big summary right at the end. What makes that difficult, to be very honest, is when you don't have control of, if, like you're the person in charge of putting that report together and you don't have access to their information till very late in the game. And that is a huge challenge. And I think, again, something that as a team, people need to work on. Like if you don't get their information until 2 days before the IEP meeting, it makes it pretty difficult to do that.
That's great.
And then the last thing I feel like there's so much information I could be sharing, but this is something that I use to sort of help with that integration and synthesis, because that seems to be the part that people struggle with the most. And so what I do, and I actually truly still do this for every evaluation I do, I create a matrix like this. I put on my left-hand side the questions I want to answer. I use this to plan my evaluation. Like, what am I going to review? Who am I going to interview? What am I going to observe if I'm trying to find data on these things? And then I use it when I'm pulling all my information together. That first question, how do health, developmental, or medical factors influence James academic achievement, educational performance? That sometimes that question like throws people, but that's really why we do a background information, because we're trying to put that child in context. And so that's my question for background information. I don't put background information in my reports. I put that question, but it's the same idea. So if you use a domain-based report, you truly could put on the left-hand side cognitive ability, social and emotional functioning, academic skills, or you could even break it down to reading, writing, math, whatever areas you're looking at. I've also done it where I use the actual education code. So I'll take the entire education code for autism in California and plunk it in there. And so, again, it helps me make sure I'm planning a solid assessment. And then once that's done, it helps me pull all my convergent data together. So when I'm looking to answer my question about his cognitive strengths, I have all my pieces of information there. This makes writing the report so much easier. And then I feel like I threw a lot of things at people very quickly, but hopefully not in an overwhelming way, that people can take just like one little bitty thing and go forward on Tuesday morning. What little thing can you do? Can you add some more information to your reason for referral so it's clearer? Can you take a little extra time to make sure that you know all your referral questions? Can you make sure you're using a variety of assessment tools? Is it really comprehensive? Can I be more involved in my pre-referral process? Literally just taking one thing. Because we know that oftentimes we hear great information, but then we go back to work and your caseload's still there, and et cetera, et cetera. And so by making those decisions now and thinking about it now, it will help you to sort of implement it when you get back into your office. And then this is just my little decree. You guys can read that later. But it's me really talking about how I feel like report writing is so valuable because it makes us much more useful as practitioners. And so an excellent evaluation can be lost in a poorly written report. Unfortunately, an excellent report can't cover up a poorly done evaluation, but really taking that time to like follow through with that full evaluation and write the report, and or even if you're not writing a full report, sharing the information you want to share in a written format can be very, very powerful. And so that's it. I'm happy to answer questions. I know I'm way over time, so I've kept you guys much later.
No, we all really appreciate it, and we had lots of viewer comments of appreciation and saying that, actually hinting that it would be really wonderful if you would be so generous to come back next year and do a part two and take some questions that maybe we didn't get to tonight.
I'm happy to do that. And I might regret I do this. It's not hard to figure out my email if you Google my name. And so I'm happy to take questions. I'm probably apprehensive to shove it up there, but I'm super, super happy to do that. So figure out where I'm at. Batman or UCI, either one of those. And if you've got questions, please, please, please ask me. I really do, I love report writing. So I'm happy if you've got specific things. Actually, I'm just going to give you my email because I don't want to be. The easiest way to get in touch with me is through my Autism Center email. So it's JCARRIER. So they took off my last E at UCI.edu. So that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk. I mean, I'm already thinking about the things that I'm going to change for sure. So really super helpful.
Yeah.
Guys, awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for giving me a few extra minutes.
Yep. And we'll be back it looks like our next episode is on 217, and we're talking about microaggressions. So that'll be a great one as well. And I don't think we have any last minute questions, but, and I'm also going to post the slides on the Google Drive. So look for that. I'll put that in the description of the YouTube description, and I'll make sure that's in the Google Drive. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks, awesome.
Everyone. Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Bye.